work for Lutheran World Relief in New York City, and I've been there about 15 months. Prior to that, I worked for the ELCA. Are all of you Lutherans?
No.
How many aren't?
Four Episcopalians.
Okay.
It's the next best thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not cold.
Very close.
Just had to back this up here.
You're wrong again, Mom.
Oh, gosh.
I think what people should.
I couldn't get in to cue this. That's a Nairobi slum. Okay. In this little series, The World is With Us at the Banquet, I've been trying to say that the Bible is perhaps interpreted in our daily life as a daily agenda. This morning, I think John said part of the theology of the crown was to speak of the Bible as a formula for your own success. And I think part of that lies in treating it as our own personal tool. But to think of it in a more expansive sense, and I held up a world book encyclopedia, the Bible as world book rather than as day book, perhaps going outwards from the Bible rather than inward, or as well as inward, and to pose a little bit that difference. And today I'll hold up a newspaper, because the two things we're focusing on in this session are a selection of Sunday texts, as in the previous sessions, but also the headlines, the daily news, and how our Christian faith perhaps can read the newspaper a little differently. And I'd invite you to add your own examples of this as we go along from your own experience and ask me for clarification on any point. The texts that I chose for this talk are from a Sunday last, in this year of January. My experience at Lutheran World Relief, where I'm the media person, is that roughly half the Sundays of the year, all kinds of things from my work pop into my head when I hear the Sunday readings. And it's on that line that I'm taking a set of texts from a Sunday and trying to share some of the connections that we have as Christians to the wider world. It could be in that same train of thought that you perhaps would also hear what I read last night from the Sudanese woman as an example of the Bible opening our eyes. In this case, an Old Testament-like prophet who is a modern Sudanese woman who has never had the Old Testament in her own language and who can pray like Ezekiel or Amos or someone like that. So I mean it as the Bible in a very concrete sense as sort of our number one helper, almost the setting the tone of this kind of work for those of us that are involved in it, and for you people in parishes who take seriously the global challenge to extend the arms of Christ, to reach out with diaconic service, with faith that is action, with a way of sharing our faith as living service to other people. I mean it very concretely. And if there are, I'm a layperson, if there are theologians among us who would like to add a more theological interpretation of these kinds of texts, please do that. The first reading of that particular Sunday is Jeremiah 17, 5 to 8. Has someone got a Bible handy? Or could get one?
You're right there, right here.
Yeah. Jeremiah 17, 5 to 8. There's another text in a minute, Psalms 1, 1 to 6, if someone else would look that up. It's a wonderful image in Jeremiah 17, 5 to 8. And as I say, when I hear a text like this now, after working with these kinds of concerns, it's almost like you're logging in to a worldwide network of stories, experiences, people who have something to do with this Holden theme of the banquet, which we're called to partake as Christians. Has someone got it?
Yeah. Thus says the Lord, cursed is the one who trusts in man and makes flesh his arm, whose heart turns away from the Lord. He is like a shrub in the desert and shall not see any good come. He shall dwell in the parched places of the wilderness, in an uninhabited salt land.
Ooh. Okay. Now some images that come to mind here. Cursed are those who trust in mere mortals and make mere flesh their strength. When I walk to work in New York City, these buses will pass me with a bus-sized naked man advertising Calvin Klein. You're faced with so many things. Putting our trust in mere flesh is how that strikes me on my way to the kind of work that goes on. They shall be like a shrub in the desert and shall not see when relief comes. Relief is here already, isn't it? Emmanuel, God with us. And also our capacity to be relief to others is also here among us in texts like this. Blessed are those who trust in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord. And then that beautiful verse 8, they shall be like a tree planted by water, sending out its roots by the stream. A verse like this, I think, the big, wide, wonderful world almost interprets the Bible for us. Like a tree planted by the water, sending out its roots by the stream. I'm wondering if we perhaps don't manage, this is kind of a Holden thought, as my wife and I have walked around, we're just stunned by what a fog we live in much of our days, and the things that get us off the track, and the way we have trouble keeping our priorities straight and doing the things we know are most important. And a verse like this makes me wonder, there's a statistic that the average bite of food in this country travels 1,500 miles to your mouth. And I pose that as an alternative sort of to this kind of verse, like a tree planted by the rivers of water, something so basic, so direct, and so powerful as it, maybe you've seen trees along the river bank here. Comparing that to the world in which we live, the New Guinea natives, the places where in the country where I grew up, had an expression for food that doesn't grow. They meant food you could buy in a store. We've been buying our food in a store for so long. Have we lost the spirit of these kinds of verses? Do we know the strength of a tree planted by rivers of water when we never see? My own kids are growing up. They don't. How much do they know about where food comes from, and the dynamics of the seasons, bringing forth its fruit in due season. This simple image, as I say, I think very powerful, comes home around the world, and perhaps you've had experiences, but perhaps nowhere more than in the Middle East, where the land is dry, and you get a wonderful sense of the cycle of birth and death, almost, as the Egyptian religion spoke, and as all the peoples of the Middle East are aware of, I think, as they see the seasons past. And I think of people in places like the desert regions of Iraq or Jordan or Syria, where villages could only live from the basic things provided by goats and sheep. There are old people there that live literally on bread and on goat's milk. That's what they grew up on. Bread and goat's milk. Yogurt, whatever they could make from goats, and occasionally killing the goat and eating the meat. That's all they grew up on. Their sensation for what it means to have a tree planted by the rivers of water. And it was my experience in the Middle East, in my previous job, to see what impact just a simple thing like a well could do in a place like that, where a village where the old people grew up eating bread and goat's milk, they now have fruit trees simply because of the presence of water. A well was sunk in a place chosen by an engineer, and this came to them thanks to the kind of work done by church agencies in this country with partners in the Middle East. Would someone read Psalm 1, 1 through 6? Yeah.
Happy are those who reject the advice of evil men, who do not follow the example of sinners, or join those who have no use for God. Instead, they find joy in obeying the law of the Lord, and they study it day and night. They are like trees that grow beside a stream, that bear fruit at the right time and whose leaves do not dry up. They succeed in everything they do, but evil men are not like this at all. They are like straw that the wind blows away. Sinners will be condemned by God and kept apart from God's own people. The righteous are guided and protected by the Lord, but the evil are on the way to their doom.
Okay. I'm going to show you something which I think dramatizes a little bit this verse, these verses in a minute. I like that beginning. Happy are those who delight in the law of the Lord. If they delight in law, imagine what they're going to feel about gospel when that comes. They're like trees planted by streams of water once again. And I think that it's fair to say, through our Christian connections of service around the world, through the places that we have a tie, to which we have a tie, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Latin America, we have a choice to almost bring this verse to life by seeking out people who know how to plant trees by rivers of water. They know where to go for those things. And some of them are Christian, some of them are not Christian. But the verse has its life whenever this happens and whenever we partake of that kind of activity, sharing what we have with what the local people have. A couple examples, one I'll mention and the other I'll show you on this short tape. In the country that used to be called Upper Volta, it's now called Burkina Faso, the simple matter of taking rocks that are spread over the desert and of arranging them in rows, they're called rock dikes. They hardly look like dikes, they're just like rows of rocks beside each other. The simple matter of doing that in a pattern across the semi-desert at the edge of the Sahara will reduce the runoff of the rains when they do come, holding the water there, allowing it to sink, improving the water table. And there are whole villages who go out and make these lines of rocks across the countryside and bring back the land that perhaps has been overgrazed or has been struck by drought. Yeah.
They also use that in southern Israel. Ben Gurion's too. They saw it in the
rock decks.
It works. Yes.
Yeah. Bringing really the salty places, the desert, back to us. I'll just turn out the light, and I'll show you another example of this. You know the conquistadors, the people we celebrated 500 years of a little while ago. There are places where people are recovering from their presence still. And one such place is high in the Andes. I think we have a focus problem here.
It's a lot further forward than it was the other day. Is that better or worse?
Maybe it's just everybody's glasses are a little bit better.
Can we just pull the table back? I think it used to work back there.
Oh,
all the way back to that.
That doesn't seem to matter. Does the lens turn at all?
No. Let me start it. These are high valleys in the Andes where the people are bringing back the alpaca. The alpaca is an animal that has soft hooves and was evolved, I guess, in that ecosystem. And it doesn't wreck the hillsides the way sheep and goats do. The Spanish brought in sheep and goats.
Far enough, otherwise it would go out and walk the ends.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see what the picture looks like.
Let's try it. Listen for the mixture of physical and spiritual comments here. You can also watch it up on the monitor.
We're in the Andes of Peru. This province, Cajamarca, is one of the poorest in the nation. In this valley, farmers have very little land, less than a half an acre at their disposal. The alpaca has an importance in the history of Peru. It's been a native animal which dates back centuries. Unfortunately, in the north part of the country where we are now,
The alpaca basically disappeared about 300 years ago, and just recently, the Center for Investigation Education for Development has recently reintroduced the alpaca to this area.
Pequenos produtores, algunas mínimas, están llegando, circa dos o tres alpacas.
One is explaining that the project works with a rotating fund, and this is how the project multiplies from family to family and from community to community. Basically, the principle is that if a farmer has, for instance, 10 births, 10 small animals from the two or three alpacas that he has in his farm, he will provide three of those 10 back to the project. And these will be shared with another family in his community or with another community. And the other 7 remain as really his working capital.
Gonna get some of those that hold it.
For Don Catalino and his family, this is a very exciting event. It's shearing time on this farm high in the Andes. Yarn from alpaca wool is a lifeline for them.
Down.
About 10,000 feet.
Don Catalino is telling us that the alpaca is a very good animal for poor families, particularly in this area where they have very little access to land, and particularly for good pasture grass. And other animals such as sheep or cows would demand more. So for poor families like Don Catalino's, with small amounts of land, very little pasture grass, the alpaca is the most appropriate animal and the best for his family's economy.
Recién estamos haciendo, pues, recién han llegado las alpacas, estamos haciendo recién.
He said recently they've acquired the alpacas. This is their first year, so they're doing some of their first shearing now. And she herself spends most of her day churning this fiber from the alpaca into thread, and then eventually transforming it into clothing. She's telling me that she's going to be making a coat for her husband out of this fiber.
Separado porque una casa puro blanco, otra casa puro negro.
Okay, so he's explaining how the family specializes in the alpacas. Their family specializes in the white alpacas, and another family would have black alpacas, and they specialize in the different colors of wool. This is from an old black alpaca that they had and have since traded with another family. So they have the 4 white ones. This is from one of the ones, which is called La Peruana, the Peruvian, which is the name of one of their alpacas. Since the family specialize in the different colors of wool, what they do is after they have all their white wool in this form, they might trade with another family, which is what they've done to get a couple of balls of the cafe color. But it's all in the system of bartering, which is very common in this region.
I'd like to warp that one.
Oh. ¿Qué acá? Por la fe de Jesús.
Our friend is explaining to us how important his Christian faith is to him in all this work. That's really part of the reason why he's doing this work, so that he can help other people live more fully and know Christ through his actions, through his work. And what he's saying to us now is that he was so pleased with our visit, because he says we're brothers and sisters even though we're separated, and we're united in this work that we share together of trying to improve people's lives here on earth. And he said how beautiful it will be if one day we find ourselves with Christ and we recognize one another's faces again. Most of all, when he looks towards the future, he speaks of helping others, of helping his neighbors as well, not just improving his own family's condition, but also opening windows of hope for the other families in this area. And so we wish him well from Lutheran World Relief, and we look forward to accompanying him and spreading this hope among his neighbors.
Gonna hit the button at the back of the top. The high one. Yeah. think that line about recognizing you when you get to heaven.
Isn't that great?
It's great. And this Don Catalino guy is, for me, that tree planted by the river of water. Sending forth its fruit. But the ending of that passage in Psalms is a little more troubling. It says about the wind driving away the wicked. And it makes you sort of wonder, do we wait for the wind to drive away the wicked? Are we the chaff ourselves that gets blown this way and that? And the gospel reading that's in that same group of readings was Luke 6, 17 to 26, and it's Luke's selection of the Beatitudes, his slightly, I think, more radical selection, and they've been discussed well here in the last 2 weeks. And I won't take the time for us to read them and discuss them in depth, except to use some of the questions that arise. The verse 17 that starts the passage touches on something, I think, where we can perhaps question even our present-day situation. If you stand where Jesus stands in verse 17 at the start of this passage, could you read just the verse 17?
And he came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases.
Okay. To stand there today, there would have to be peace and to speak to all those people. Has anybody been in that area? Where the Mount Sermon is, the Sermon on the Mount. Has anybody been there? If he was standing and facing in a certain direction, on his left, this is Jesus, okay? This is his nose. On his left would be the Golan Heights. On his right is Mount Tabor, the Mount of Transfiguration. The place is mentioned. At his back is the south of Lebanon. And straight ahead in the far distance, considerable distance, would be Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives. And if you look at each of those places, if that crowd had to gather today, there would have to be peace, because who's on the Golan Heights? The Syrians. Who's in the south of Lebanon? The Israeli surrogate militia who control the area for them, the southern Lebanese allies of the Israeli occupation. In Mount Tabor and towards this area is the heavy Palestinian population of Galilee, Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. And straight ahead down towards Jerusalem, on this side you have the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And down here you have Jerusalem, a divided city, where one side is dwindling, the other side is getting more powerful. And every year that passes plays into the hands of one side and plays against the hopes of the other side and of the people, the 1.2 million Muslims in the world who consider that to be a holy city, the 1.5 million Christians who may consider it to be a holy city. Those two groups are losing ground as the time goes on. They mention in the verse Tyre and Sidon, Tyre being in that South Lebanon part, Sidon being a place where Palestinians live in camps now for 40 years, 50 years. A little bit of the imagery of the wickedness not being driven away, and perhaps what is our role in it, of allowing this to continue. Because in the relief and development business as Christian agencies, what we've had to do in that part of the world, there's one place where Lutheran World Relief has been involved for 50 years. That's that place. A sort of suspended relief. A sort of not quite ever getting into what you might call development. Why? Because of the lack of a just settlement between the two contending parties in that part of the world. And so it's a mixture of permanent relief and trying to say things about advocacy back here to raise the basic questions without which there will not be much hope, I think. And watching the peace process and having to say that it seems like so far, at least one side is under the impression that peace is cheap, can be done by nickels and dimes, by never coming to the basic questions. That divided city of Jerusalem, not yet on the table, not yet discussed. The Jewish settlements in the West Bank, not yet discussed. The Israeli control of two-thirds of the West Bank, really not yet discussed. They argue, they talk for 6 months on whether or not the Israeli troops should get out of the Palestinian towns on the West Bank. And all of the time, the settlement movement going on, because they are building in the existing settlements. They're expanding them. It makes you want to buy some satellite photos and show what's been done since that handshake on the White House lawn. Show what's been going on the ground, the facts on the ground, that contrast with the talk at the table and the headlines in the paper, which allow us to say, well, peace is broken out in the Middle East. Let's not pay so much attention to it anymore. These are, I think, the troubling questions that arise, and they echo, for me at least, the Beatitude questions. Blessed are you who are poor, blessed are you who are hungry. The other, blessed are the peacemakers, almost turning them around and saying, how blessed are they? On this issue of the poor and the hungry, right in the news again now, I don't know if any of you are following the papers, they come here a couple days late, but something real interesting is happening in the other major trouble spot, I think, for relief agencies at this time and for the past year in the country of Rwanda and Zaire and Tanzania. The Zairians are getting sick of having a million Rwandans on their eastern border. And in the last 4 or 5 days, they have begun to deport them and dump them at the border in the town of Goma, dump them at the border of Rwanda, where there are already some people camping who can't get into the country. And dumping, I think they've done 12,000 so far of these. And meanwhile, 130,000 refugees have fled deeper into Zaire to avoid being sent home in this new move. And this is a place where the image that I think is strongest is the idea of a smoldering volcano. There are volcanoes behind the town of Goma. One erupted in 1970 and created a vast lava field down beside the town. And it's on that lava field that one of the refugee camps with 250,000 people is placed. And even as that volcano smolders behind the town, and you can see red, be like if Copper Mountain was a volcano and the clouds are above it at night, the red in the caldera is reflected off the clouds at night, and you have a sense for the power of that place. Well, it's much like the politics, I think, of Rwanda, where the volcano of genocide, the volcano that was unleashed on those people by an extremist faction of their own government, willing to hold on to power at all costs, was able to really crack the country open and form this human flow of lava, of refugees, of literally half the country having to leave home and a quarter of the country having to flee their own borders, sitting there and smoldering. And Zaire in desperation saying, enough, we're sending them back. And trying to get attention, I think, to the problem by that device. So how blessed are the poor. With those refugees, on a visit I made there last October, the question rings for a particular family where you meet and you find them actually eating some more or less normal-looking food, and you ask them where they got these chickpeas and this little bit of meat that they're cooking up into a stew. And what they had decided to do as a family was to sell their UN rations, which the Lutheran World Federation is helping to hand out and manage in these camps, sell their UN rations for 3 days in order to buy one decent meal, in their mind, of the kind of food they used to eat back in Rwanda. And they told me very clearly that what they had between eight of them right there in that pot on that fire was what they would have 3 times a day back in their own country. But here it was a special feast for which they apparently were willing to sell 2 or 3 days of rations. How blessed are those poor? How blessed are those hungry? Another group I met with was a group of church workers whose job it is to try to rebuild some kind of community life in the camps, with initiatives to reactivate women's groups or youth groups or schools or sports clubs. Very simple community level activity life into something that is a little bit more than just despair and perhaps breeding ground for another war as this former government takes these refugees back in and tries to take the country again. And what was shocking in that with the group of church workers for me was the fact that they, being from the side that had fled, therefore being from the people who had thrown in their lot with the discredited government, the government behind the genocide, even as Christians, they were so torn by what had happened that there wasn't a word of regret about the genocide. As I looked for that feeling of at least analysis of what had happened, what they gave was a defense and a saying, they would say, you should hear what the other side did to us. If you understand the politics in Rwanda enough for this to make sense, there was a rebel group invading the country for 3 years, from 1990 to the time of the genocide. And as that rebel group invaded, many people suffered because there was civil war. And one of the people in the group I was talking to was a pastor who had had to leave his own parish 3 years previously and had moved to stay in front of the rebels for 3.5 years to try to come to a safer place. And it was always move, 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 and finally moved to Zaire as everybody fled in July last year. But as you know, under the cover of that civil war, the government that was being defeated in the end put into action its final solution, and its final solution was to kill moderate Hutus and any Tutsi they could find. And they prepared their population with enough propaganda so that members of the population took part or were forced to take part, were not given any choice. And then when the tables were turned, were forced to flee with them, almost as hostages, for fear of reprisal. And among those who fled for fear of reprisal were these Christians I was speaking to. And their sense for the tragedy was to say, look what those people did to us. Not our side did a terrible thing, therefore they replied, or we're both guilty. Not even that, but this brokenness out of which they could only charge the other side with the evils that it had in many cases also committed, but perhaps nowhere near on the scale of their own leadership. So it raises the question, what does this mean? You know, like a tree planted by rivers of water is a wonderful image, and we can relate quickly to the fine Christian peasant in Peru. But what does it mean? Blessed are the poor, blessed are the hungry. And I think that it becomes at least something of closer focus for us when we turn it around as a question and say to the Bible verses on Sunday, how blessed, in this case, how blessed are the poor, how blessed are the hungry. Do we just wait, let them wait until their leaders sort themselves out? Do we wash our hands of it? Because as Americans, we pretty much did that. We took part in the disaster in a very limited way, our government did, during the height of the cholera, after the vast amount of damage had been done. People were crying from within Rwanda, church workers, pastors, relief agencies, even some of the diplomatic staff on the site were saying, do something to stop the genocide. It's like the screw was being turned deeper and deeper and deeper. And you and I, as a nation, only reacted when it was so far gone that what we saw was the flight to Zaire, and what we saw was the cholera, which killed a pittance of people, compared to the 500,000 or perhaps million who died during the genocide, which was carried out, as I say, under the cover of the civil war. We spent our time arguing with the UN whether to use the word genocide. Our government would not use the word genocide until late June when most everybody was dead. We argued 5 weeks with the UN about how much they should pay us to rent armored cars, which they would need, because there were African troops willing to go in there and try to do something. Ghana volunteered a division. Other countries, Tanzania, Mozambique, had troops ready to go, but they needed, in some cases, boots, they needed rifles, they needed vehicles. And we argued with the UN how much they would pay us to rent our armored cars and fly them down from Germany. 5 weeks, how much to pay us. And we owe the UN hundreds of millions of dollars in unpaid dues as the richest country on the planet, as the one who has the most to lose, really, for international disorder. I think a very troubling question for us. And even another way to look at it is to see what France did. France had been arming and siding with the Hutu extremist government, which ended up doing these things. And yet it got so bad and nobody did anything that France was able to come in and secure the southwestern corner of the country. About a quarter of the country was occupied by France in an occupation that started in the middle of June for a month called Operation Turquoise. And they stopped the genocide from coming to the southwest. And they looked good, even though they were heavily compromised and supporters of the regime. They looked good in stopping that regime's genocide because nobody had done anything. And if it had been Angola, or if it had been Afghanistan, we were France. We would have been in the same boat as having armed one side, having backed one side against the Soviets, and having been in a position perhaps to have that much blood on our hands by association as accomplices to those things. So we can look at France and question what they did, at the same time as we have to, I think, look at our own participation in some of these terrible events around the world that turn those Beatitudes on their head and say, how blessed are the poor, when those with power in so-called Christian nations do not respond, do not perhaps take a little bit more of a Christian view, I think, or at least a human rights view. Now, this is maybe a position that makes you think, well, we can't be the world's policemen. I mean, it's not easy to nail this down, but...
It actually starts, I think, before that.
Pardon?
It actually starts before that, and we have some blame to accept. Most of the ammunition, the armaments and so forth,
yeah,
they didn't get given to them.
Right.
They didn't make themselves. And most of them probably came from us.
Yeah.
And, they didn't have some of that hardware.
Right.
Some of the things might still occur, but... So I think, we could start...
Earlier.
A couple of segments back, facilitating, or in some cases running it. Some of these things. Of course, we wouldn't have the economy, because we wouldn't have the arms sales and that sort of thing. But maybe we'd have more peace.
So, the genocide done by machetes of this.
The fervor and the mentality and whatever obviously is fed by the fact that they have weapons now and machetes.
Yeah. Rwanda wasn't awash in weapons. You had to actually pay if you wanted a bullet. The militia would, you had to pay them, then you could get killed by a bullet instead of a machete.
They'd be chopped up.
Yeah. Mm. You were going to say something?
I was going to say. I think the United States is cutting back on the weaponry they supply, but I also think other nations just
jumping right in.
Crazy China and some of the other
China,
nations.
France, Britain, Brazil. It's
cutting back. Maybe
a tough one.
Feel that it won't solve anything.
You know, a really depressing statistic on arms is landmines.
Yeah.
There's one for every man, woman, and child in Angola, for example. And it costs something like $3 to $10 to actually put a landmine in the ground.
Yeah.
Manufacture it and put it. It costs $300 to $1,000 to pick it up. Mm-hmm. and they're silent killers sitting there long, long after the actual war is gone.
And actually, what was it? They last perfectly good for at least 30 years, yeah. Right where they are, and maybe, I mean, could literally forever. Some of them are made out of plastic. You know, right. They can't detect them, and you are right. That's the biggest mess.
It's terrible. Cambodia, Angola, Mozambique, Afghanistan, some of the worst countries for it. Ethiopia, parts of Ethiopia, Eritrea.
Which will longer last. I was reading this piece in the paper, I think 6 months ago, that some French farmer uncovered a shell in World War II in his fields.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's just still around. And you're lying shells.
Yeah. Even bombs. Yeah, just went into the swamps and didn't explode.
Right. To turn it again, I would say that how blessed are the poor, how blessed are the hungry in cases like this. Actually, in the case of Rwanda, in terms of just picking up the pieces and dealing with the damage after it was done, rather than since the governments didn't take care of the causes and didn't stop, you know, the powers that be did not stop the crime from happening. But churches and other groups have reacted in a wonderful way, because there's been something called Church World Action Rwanda, which is an ecumenical umbrella saying that if Lutheran World Federation has great management skills, airlifting capacity, they should do that. If Christian Aid has great local development capacity at village level, they should do that. If somebody else knows water systems, they should do that. And they've arranged the tasks among the agencies for the case of Rwanda. So the irony is, despite this incredibly depressing thing, where 1 in 6 Rwandans was probably killed last year, you know, it was a Holocaust. Holocausts aren't only what happened to the Jewish people in World War II. There's been at least 2 since then, one in Cambodia, this one in Rwanda. Despite that, the aid operation has been a model. And it's been successful enough that agencies like the World Council of Churches, the World Federation, and so on, are ready to make it permanent and call it, look for this name, I hope. I hope it becomes well known. It's called ACT, Action by Churches Together. And if there's a crisis, you're going to see, I hope, if people like me are doing our job, the name ACT Rwanda in the paper. And that will be the combined ecumenical aid offering of agencies like what the Danes have, the Norwegians, the Swedes, the Germans, and the Americans. From the old, well-established, 50-year-long aid agencies. So that's something to keep in mind. Those teams I met with, they're doing lots of good work. I wasn't too impressed by their willingness to face the facts, but doing good work at the local level. And inside Rwanda, the same kind of thing as people resettle. In Tanzania, where 500,000 people are camped, the LWF is running a water system the size of a small city in the middle of nowhere to keep those people in water, to keep sanitation at a certain level. Some quite wonderful things going in. The first plane into Goma was a Lutheran World Federation plane. Who flew there? How did CNN get there to take the pictures you saw? They flew on a Lutheran World Federation plane to get in there to those cholera epidemic at Goma. So many things to be said about what was done. But the sadness of it is, in a case like this, I think, that it's really dealing with a little part of the symptoms when the causes are also challenged by something as radical as the texts on Sunday, when those happen to be the Beatitudes. So I'd say the Beatitudes, the Bible, in this case again, opens our eyes and actually asks us questions which we have to answer. If we switch to something else, the public media, and we've given a bunch of examples here, you know, the alpacas and the Rwanda case, the Palestine case. If we switch over to public media, 2 things to say. Here we had questions, you know, get your questions out of the Bible if you like. My suggestion here would be to go behind the news. And you know how few of us actually read newspapers anymore, and how there's more on this front page than you'll have in the whole Peter Jennings half hour.
For sure.
There's more words here than all of Peter Jennings in half an hour. Go behind the news and then go beyond the news, because so much is never there for us to see. And my favorite illustration of that is that O.J. Simpson's Bronco got more time last year on national television than the million people who died in Rwanda. You know, as Christians, I would almost say, please shoot me down right now, but I would almost say it's almost sinful to watch television as if you're going to be informed about anything.
Amen. That's the truth, too.
Nobody disagrees? Can we go home?
Just out of curiosity, what do you think it was that Rwanda was covered quite well compared to what's happening in Sudan
yeah.
the last 30 years or so? It's not covered. You never see it.
Yeah, well, Rwanda wasn't covered very well until Goma. I mean, it was, but...
There's been a million killed in Sudan, I understand.
Yeah. There's been a million killed in the last 10 years. It's the rough estimate. And, I it's out of the Cold War arena. It's a country we don't know much about. It's a huge country. It's got a rotten infrastructure. It's hard to get the news out. And this kind of story I read last night, I've got another one here I could read. Is part of the church effort to give voice to those people. Dan Church Aid has actually allocated a full-time church media person to bring out stories from the Sudanese refugees, especially in the camps around Khartoum. There are desert camps around Khartoum, which are in terrible conditions. And one of the stories that came out was of a woman who was, where her village was sacked by militiamen from the north. And I think it's important for us to be careful on the labels we use here, because it's real easy to talk about Arabs, Arab militia. And the Arabs have enough prejudice against them. We don't need to call them that. Let's call them fundamentalists. Let's call them an extremist government who is mobilizing people to do its dirty deeds. Let's call them something else, more pointed, more immediate than an ethnic label. But this militia came into her village, killed many people, took away the women. She became the property of one of the militiamen. She became pregnant. She had the baby. It was born, she said, with big ears and red hair. And what she means is it's a someone who is half Nilotic, half Southern Sudanese black, and half Arab. And in her eyes, ugly for many reasons. She escaped from the man with her baby and got to a camp near Khartoum. And a few days after she arrived, as she told in her own words while she was feeding the baby, she squeezed it to death. And that was the story she told to the aid agencies, the people gathering these stories. You know, the stories we never hear, but a story of the Civil War in one woman's body. And, you know, Jimmy Carter, praise God, what that guy does. Always happy to say I voted for him. But, you know, he arranged a little truce there for a while. They could work on this guinea worm project. And they were probably going to stop fighting anyway because it was the wet season. They usually slow down then. So it was a good time to talk about peace. There are steps that can be made. And I think the most depressing thing is not to think we can solve it, but perhaps, as John Strand said this morning, not to give the advice, but to be there. Are we there for the Sudanese people? Rebecca, the prophet, last night puts her hope in America. You know? God is her airplane. She means the Lutheran World Federation airplane that brings them the food. She wants a sign from us. She wants hope from us. And they're getting it from the church agencies. But the church agencies, I think, are saying, wait a minute, this isn't enough. We can't just go on dealing with the victims of the casualties. You know, I think our reading of the daily news has to raise some of these deeper questions, the stories that aren't there and the questions behind the stories. I picked up today's paper. I'll give you a choice. Would you like a little exegesis of Thursday's August 24th, New York Times, three or four stories, and your link to them through agencies like Lutheran World Relief, or perhaps more unique, I think, would be another story from Sudan.
They both make us cry, right?
No, this one's really uplifting. Let's get uplifted.
But sometimes I'd like at least a couple of comments about Bosnia.
Okay, I had a list here of typical stories right now. And Bosnia, in the part that is Croatia, which recently expanded when they took Krajina back, what we're involved in is dealing with elderly refugees who were Croatians living in Bosnia, who fled as the ethnic cleansing went on, needing a place to live, living in schools and refurbished old people's homes, feeding programs at orphanages, helping schools get rebuilt, helping that country sort of get back on its feet in localities where we're active. And the names you read in the paper, Bihać and places like that, Banja Luka, and, that's in, I think, Bosnia, but are places where this stuff goes on. So it's there, but it also has that feeling of low-grade, suspended, permanent relief, if you like, because of the lack of a political will to bring a settlement. And I think that this makes me say, in the atmosphere of the present Congress and the kind of things we hear from Washington, that we shouldn't be interested. That's not good enough. We don't have to do it ourselves. There is a United Nations. There is an international community. There is international standards. There's a genocide convention, for God's sake. There are things in it that we could have done that would not have required laying down the lives of our famous boys, you know? And even there, aren't there boys who would lay down their life? Aren't there professional soldiers who wouldn't mind fighting for a just cause? Is there such a thing as worthwhile use of force? I tend to think there is. I mean, we've had some peace seminars here, but I'm not so sure there isn't. So from the relief point of view and the frustration, I think, at the same time as the necessity of dealing with the brokenness, you have to scream and say, why does this keep going on? Why can this still happen in this day and age? And that's where we are. I mean, if the Croats taking Krajina somehow corrects the balance and allows them and the Serbs to settle it, the Muslims are stuck with what they have.
Again, it was a lot of it had to do with foreigners that either were or weren't coming
right
in. You sell people those weapons and all of a sudden they
yep.
do things and think things that...
right.
And so the rest of the world is perhaps replacing some of the arms sales. I guess I still feel better that
doesn't make me
doing it,
right. Doesn't mean it's right for us.
Just one question about the Middle East or Israel. You were talking about that before, but
right.
isn't almost an unsolvable problem because I'm waiting to say that the main aquifer which supplies Israel is under the
West Bank.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're going to give that up.
That's right.
Do they want peace? They're going to have to make some kind of a deal.
They for sure want that water.
You know?
They're taking it, and they've been taking it. There was a big article in the National Geographic about that water.
An Israeli settler in the West Bank uses 9 times as much water as a Palestinian resident who's been there all of his life and for hundreds of years. He pays a quarter as much as the Palestinian does for the 1/9 the Palestinian gets. The 2,000 settlers in Gaza, pardon?
The 1/9. The older
the Palestinians get. Yeah, and Palestinians get one part, Israelis get 9 parts. The Palestinian part costs 4 times as much per gallon as the 9 parts. You know, they can do swimming pools.
Whoa.
They can do gardens and wonderful terracing. Palestinians are down there with wells that don't even go as deep as the Israeli well, drug from the hillside down deeper than the Palestinian well.
And add a slant and take the water out of the well from the other people.
The 2,000 settlers, they're settlers in Gaza. Of all the crazy ideas in this world, has anybody been to Gaza?
Yeah.
You know, that is the ends of the earth. 1 million people on a strip of sand, 6 miles by 24 miles, living there in a cement refugee camp for 50 years. You want to breed fundamentalists? Put them in on 6 by 24 mile strip of sand. Give them no hope. The only hope they have is Allah. The 2,000 settlers, there are 20 settlements in that strip. They use more water than the million Palestinians for their orange groves.
But
this is madness.
We're
paying for it.
Well, but it's even worse than that. all the water users that you're talking about, how about the Kuwaitis?
The Kuwaitis?
Yeah.
What, in relation to water?
Oh, yeah.
With nuclear desalinization?
Well, and off of the Jordan River and so forth, it's and the lifestyles over there, and we protected them.
We protected the rights of the men.
And this sort of thing, even though we're not right in Israel and so forth, that's sort of thing, we're still bucking it up.
You know, to admit that there are more sides there than one side would help, would be a start. Let me bring it to a close with a couple comments. I'll just finish this little diagram. My premise would be that if we take the signs that the Bible gives us about the questions to ask and the concerns that we have to have as Christians for the wider world, this over-the-horizon Christianity, this World Book Bible, this Daily News Bible, and if we somehow get beyond or behind the news, and how are you going to do that? There are good media out there. There are good magazines on every region of the world that you can order on a monthly basis. There's stuff on the internet. That Rebecca the Prophet that I read last night, that came on Lutherlink. Yeah, praise God. You know, Southern Sudan is here on Lutherlink. It's called A Year in South Sudan by an Episcopal priest who went back there, who knew the language. He put his journal on the Lutheran. Get beyond it. Get behind it somehow. Make people like me work. You know, I'm there with all this good stuff. If any of you want to stay in touch through electronic mail, through receiving press releases and things like that, bothering people like Kathleen Hurdy at 475 Riverside, you know, make us work. Make us know that there's an audience out there, a hungry, participatory audience that wants to be connected as part of their Christian citizenship. If you put all that together and it does come to life for us in good ways and bad, you know, that alpaca is a wonderful story, Rwanda is a disaster, but there's also points of light in every place that we can look to. I think you have something like a foretaste of the feast to come, an invitation to many people we don't otherwise think about to be at that feast. They are sitting with us at the feast that God has laid out. And I think that is a place where our riches are actually paling in comparison to the riches that other people bring. If we think of the real riches that moth and rust cannot corrupt, for me it's something like what that woman said last night. That sense of faith and of what God really means, spoken out of her darkest hour. And I'll take my last 3 or 4 minutes, unless there's another burning comment or question, to read you a little tiny other story. These are from Sudanese refugees who, in the last 4, 5, maybe 6 years, have gathered at a place called Kakuma in northern Kenya. Legions of boys who were in danger of being conscripted by the north or by one of the rebel factions and turned into young soldiers, who actually escaped without parents by their thousands and came to this camp. And this guy writes, the agencies like Lutheran World Federation, UNHCR, Swedish Save the Children, have to be commended in that camp for the diverse services they provide, encompassing food, water, housing, health, education, feeding centers for the children, and therapy for the amputees. Essential as these services are, however, they are temporary. Developed and sustained by aliens, they do not, by and large, arise from the impulse of Sudanese. Even the schools, so greatly valued and so important for the formation of young minds, are less potent than the two forces which presently drive the psyche in exile. That most dynamic force, social, psychological, and spiritual well-being, are those which refugees themselves create and sustain. It is in the churches that the souls well up in prayer, retelling and relieving the trauma of the past. Here, hostilities of clan and tribe diminish as a surrogate family affirms its common vision. Here, exiles cast themselves upon a God who transforms suffering through love. This yearning of spirit is essentially poignant, especially poignant among Kakuma's 11,000 unaccompanied minors. 11,000 unaccompanied minors. A phrase which becomes increasingly euphemistic as those remarkable boys enter manhood. They've been there long enough now. It was their arrival in Kenya during July 92, then numbering some 19,000. Any of you hear about it?
No.
19,000 boys walking across the desert into northern Kenya. They'd been in Ethiopia, and they did a huge trek back and forth, various camps along the way, 3 years on the road, ending up at Kakuma in northern Kenya. The saga of most began amidst the escalating military conflict of 87 when they were between 4 and 15 years of age. Some lads fled the carnage having witnessed the massacre of kinfolk. Others were sent away by their parents desperate to preserve a future generation. Most lads dreamed of education in Ethiopia while many determined to defend their homeland as liberation fighters. Their eastward passage, covering hundreds of desolate miles, saw the deaths of thousands, still more starving during early months in ill-equipped reception camps. Boys recall how the young cried when they first confronted death, until it became so commonplace they disposed of friends' corpses without emotion. With the support of the UN, the camps gradually stabilized, food arrived, and rudimentary schools emerged. Still, after 4 years in Ethiopia, the lads endured yet another harrowing trek in 91, back to Sudan and ultimately to Kenya.